this applies to lots of DEI initiatives, which is, I think, if it's used in isolation or to disrupt part of a process on its own, then frankly, it's probably not going to work.
So my guest for today is Ella, and Ella has been in our podcast before. We made an episode about D&I in the boardroom. And today with Ella, we are going to talk about blind recruitment and in particular, anonymizing a CV. So the topics that we are going to cover is, what is it actually anonymizing a CV? What do you actually anonymize then? How is that impacting maybe your showing your personality or not showing your personality in a CV? And what kind of recruiter biases come into play when we are talking about anonymizing a CV, yes or no? So I hope you will enjoy this episode today.
Now, before we are going to dive into the topic that we will discuss today, Ella, it would be great if you can briefly introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Ella. We got in contact initially with Equalture because I was doing a role, a director of diversity and inclusion role at a company, and we were looking at ways to overhaul our hiring process. So very topical. But what I now do is I have a consulting company where I focus on providing DEI consultancy to companies, to scaling companies predominantly. And there's some leadership culture work that I do as well. And what I tend to find is that DEI and management and leadership culture are kind of inextricably linked. So, you know, you can't really handle one without looking at the other.
Yeah, I fully agree. Thanks so much for the introduction. I already mentioned it to you up front. For me personally, anonymized hiring, we called it blind recruitment here in the link, by the way, but that's for a good reason. So we will come to that in a second. I find it always a bit of a tricky topic to talk about and to also express my opinion about. And the reason for that is, well, I think I'm in quite a privileged situation. I come from the Netherlands. I have a very wide sounding name. Is that also how you feel about this, Ella? Do you get what I'm saying here?
I do. And I think for me personally, I kind of straddle both in a way. So, and what I mean by that is I have quite a white sounding name. I'm not white, but on paper, people might, I've got a double barreled name, which in the UK has quite a kind of almost posh connotation. That's not the reason I have a double barreled name. I went to some private schools and I went to a quite prestigious university. Quite a few of those things are almost accidental. The reason I went to private school was because I got lots of scholarships to go to the local private school, and that's the kind of route I went down. But I'm from quite a working class background. But on paper, to your point, my CV would absolutely get through the kind of generally biased criteria. And on the other hand, because of my background and because I have working class parents and because I have Black family and because I have siblings who've gone down a different route, I think I've got an insight into that sphere where people have less privilege. And on the other hand, I feel like I tick some of the more privileged boxes as well.
Yeah. I already mentioned it, of course. We call it blind recruitment or blind hiring in the title. We actually did that for a reason because I think it touched upon the very first topic that might be good to clarify here. Because what you usually see, I also did a Google search, so I found that the search results for blind hiring / recruitment were much higher than for anonymized hiring and recruitment. But why is it actually better to use the term anonymized hiring rather than blind hiring?
Put bluntly, I suppose, when we use blind in this context, it's a kind of ableist language, basically. But I think this is a really interesting topic because, to your point, it's important that you use that title for a reason. It's the most widely used way of referring to this phenomenon that we're going to talk about. And on the other hand, it's ableist. And so I think it's a kind of interesting insight into this wider kind of conversation that's happening at the moment around how ingrained in our language ableist vocabulary is, to the point that we kind of don't even notice it. I don't know if you saw recently in the media, both Beyonce and Lizzo had to go back and change some of the lyrics in their songs, recent songs. And I would argue that they're both quite inclusive, quite aware artists. But it was only once they got a kind of bit of backlash that they went back and said, oh, okay, I need to change this. And so there's an interesting conversation, I think, to be had here about how we just take this kind of language for granted and don't even, it doesn't even necessarily occur if we're not from a disabled community that's impacted by it.
Yeah. And what I always find the most important thing here is, obviously, you will make, well, mistakes is maybe also a negative word, but there will be terms you're using that might not be the best ones to use. And I think it's always good to try to make people aware of it without blaming and shaming them for using it. So more constructive way of saying, hey, maybe this term is actually better to use. But it's good that we clarify this. So we are going to talk about anonymized hiring from this point onwards. Hey, if we look at the concept of anonymizing your resume, what information is most often being removed then from the resume? Or what would people in general advise you to remove from your resume?
So the most obvious, I think most common things are your name, any identifiable, quote unquote, details. So name, age, address, things like that. But I think that there's an interesting conversation again to be had around whether are we anonymizing the hiring process or are we just anonymizing the CV? So for instance, I know there was a law firm in the UK that selectively anonymized parts of the resume, and part of what they anonymized was the university that people went to. So that's not necessarily one of the more common fields, but the reason they did that was that they identified that they had a problem with bias towards Oxbridge graduates and things like that. So you can also take out other details if you've identified that you've got a kind of a specific bias in your organization, but they tend to be the more common features.
Yeah. And why do you think that companies apply anonymized recruitment in the first way? What do you think that they hope to achieve by implementing this practice?
So I like to believe that intentions are normally good. And I think there are drawbacks to this approach, which we can talk about. But I think the intention, or in my experience, the intention tends to be there's a realization that we are hiring in some form or other a homogenous group of people, whether that's homogenous from a kind of demographic perspective, whether it's homogenous from a people from a certain walk of life. And often that comes accidentally. People like us hire people like us. And the desire with doing some kind of anonymizing is, I guess, to disrupt those patterns that we've fallen into in how we hire and who we hire.
So maybe as a small background story, well, you know my founding story of this company, of course, but we started a couple of years ago. And one of the reasons why the main reason why we started eCulture is to remove bias from the hiring process. And so I used to have a recruitment agency before I started this company, and I saw a lot of cases of discrimination, but I think the one that stood out most to me was we worked for a very big Dutch enterprise. Of course, I'm not going to mention the name here, but what happened is that I introduced them to a candidate of which I thought this is their perfect candidate. It ticks all the boxes. And she was actually being rejected for the reason. I know this is going to sound very harsh, but literally one of the people from the management team called me and said, we find her name too difficult here, so we are not going to continue with this candidate. I know you would hope that that's not happening anymore, but we are talking about 2017, 2018. At least back then, comments like these were still made out in the open, which made me wonder, and that's, I think, the internal conflict that I have with anonymizing the resume. So I'm curious about your view on that. Is what would have happened if I would introduce this candidate to the company with an anonymized profile. Then the candidate would be invited to a job interview, and then they would still find out all the details. Would it really then make a difference? That's, I think, always the struggle that I'm having. What is your perspective on that?
Yes, so I have the same struggle with this. My view is that, as with a lot of kind of DEI initiatives, which is often what anonymized hiring is part of, is some kind of DEI initiative. This applies to lots of DEI initiatives, which is, I think, if it's used in isolation or to disrupt part of a process on its own, then frankly, it's probably not going to work. And so what sometimes happens, I think, is companies will say, well, we're going to just blind the CV. So we're going to anonymize the CVs. I slipped into that there. And we've ticked that box. Great. We've done what we could. We tried, and it's a kind of an excuse to say we tried to do a thing and we're just going to continue doing things the way that we've done them. And so to your point, I think it can work really well, and there are kind of documented examples of it working really well. But if you're just taking the identifiable features off of a CV, but you're still sourcing in the same way, you're still doing the same interview stages, the same panel of people, you've not thought about your decision-making processes and the bias that might be involved in them, mm-hmm. you're not likely to get a vastly different result. You might get a more diverse pool of candidates further into the process, but your decision-making process is still your decision-making process, right?
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is, it is a good first step, but if you do it in isolation without applying any other D&I practices to the hiring process, it's probably not going to have a real impact on improving D&I.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it does depend. So interestingly, this kind of anonymized approach, one of the origins of it, or one of its first kind of use cases, was in the Symphony Orchestra in Toronto. I don't know if you mm-hmm. read about it.
Yeah.
And you know, the way that they used it was to get people to audition behind a curtain, and they would just decide based on that completely anonymous audition. In a context like that, you have a one-step audition process. The only thing you need to know is whether or not this person can play their instrument well enough to join your orchestra, and that's about it. And so anonymizing that part of the process works incredibly effectively, because that's the only part of your process. And yeah. Also, orchestras have quite low turnover and things like that. I think where you have, and this is true of a lot of companies who I work with, certainly, is it's a little bit more complex than that. There are more stages than that. There's more sourcing processes that happen, and there's steps in the process. So I think if you have a four-step process and you're anonymizing one step of it, that person's not going to be anonymous for long.
Yeah.
So you have to overhaul the whole thing, in my view.
Yeah, check. I'm going to park that for a second because I would like to dive a little bit deeper into, hey, what could you do then in addition to anonymizing resumes in order to make sure that you also make the steps following up on that, or at least more enabling for D&I. One other point that I wanted to touch upon, so that is my first internal struggle, let's say, like, how effective is it if you then in an interview actually see someone? So I think we tackled that one. The other one, and I think someone in our community also asked a question about it earlier this week. So he asked, what can you anonymize still in your resume without erasing your personality, basically? And that brings me to my second internal struggle with this topic. Like, to what extent are we indeed removing our some sort of identity and uniqueness from a resume in order for the person evaluating the resume not to get biased when looking at you? It sounds a bit unfair. Like, it sounds a bit like the candidate needs to basically compensate for the bias of the recruiter, if you approach it very black and white. I know it's not that black and white, but what's your view on that?
It's complicated. So I agree broadly with that black and white statement. It's almost like a really blunt way of putting it would be, you know, you don't want to have to pronounce my name, so we're just removing my name. which ultimately, you know, is more complex than that. But I think this is part of why it has to be part of not only a bigger process, but I think a larger kind of strategy. If it can be a useful way of interrupting our biased kind of patterns. We all have patterns of thinking. We all have biases. We all have, as humans, natural ways of automatically kind of quickly categorizing people. And when we look at a resume, what we're often doing, if we're honest with ourselves, is scanning for those things. Oh, did you go to a university I respect? Ooh, what grade did you get? Did you work for a company that I think is a good company? You know, I'm making all of these kind of quick judgments. Am I really going to the depth of what you did and what you achieved? Maybe, but I've already kind of made some of those prejudgments. And so I think if you anonymize parts of the process, you're removing my ability to make those judgments before I've seen the depth of your ability, which I believe is a good thing. However, if all we do is interrupt that pattern and then we don't do anything to address my bias more deeply, or I should more say the systemic bias in the organization, because I don't think it is a personal thing per se, then even if our hiring process is wildly successful and we manage to get a really diverse pool of candidates through the door and we change our diversity profile of the company, those people are going to leave if we don't address some of the kind of deeper issues at play, I think.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. I think there's a big difference between literally removing any possibility to get biased by looking at someone's demographics, name, university, etc., versus going back to the root cause of why do I even have that bias in the first place. So would you say then that, for example, training should be something that in an ideal world, the training on unconscious biases, forms of discrimination, in an ideal world, should everyone get that in the hiring process?
Yes, all of the above. I mean, there's a lot of debate around unconscious bias training and whether it's effective and whether it works. Again, I think part of the issue is that often it's done in isolation, and the way that it's approached is kind of everybody come, do some unconscious bias training, right? We all become aware that we're unconsciously biased and go back to your day job. And so my view on DEI is that these things should be quite a holistic approach. Training is one rung of it. Disrupting and changing processes is one big part of it. It doesn't sound like a very sexy thing, but I think fundamentally DEI for me is about changing processes. Yeah. And so there's a kind of changing attitudes, there's a changing process, systemic processes, there's a kind of educational piece. I think that they're all pieces that should be part of the whole.
Yeah. But if we first go to the stages following up on screening candidates, so I think we all agree that anonymizing resumes could be a first step towards DEI, but then of course following up on that, usually companies have either a phone screening or a set of interviews, cases, and then they come to a final hiring decision. Mm. You already mentioned it, unconscious bias training is not always that, maybe not always that effective. I think it also maybe something to do with the fact that it should be tangible and practical. What can you do now that you know this? If we applied it to this conversation, what are two or three very practical things we can do post-screening to make sure that we extend the effect of an anonymized resume?
Ooh, I mean, if we're talking about the kind of stages of the hiring process, I would say that what we've focused on broadly, which is anonymizing parts of a resume, could go a lot further. So I think you're a big proponent of this, but first of all, I think there's a big question mark around whether we need a CV at all. And if we don't need a CV, what about a CV does work? What information do we need? What information do we want to be able to test? So I would say you can actually anonymize more about the process, get rid of the CV, get people to do tasks of some kind, or get people to kind of fill in information about how they would approach different things. And so I think you can approach more steps in the hiring process than just the kind of resume screening step with this kind of philosophy. The caveat I would add is I don't think you want to make it too cumbersome. I think there's a problem with making application processes really, really time consuming for candidates, especially if I'm applying to 10 different roles, that's really that's a full-time job pretty quickly. And I think you need to be aware of kind of different people's needs and things like that. But I think that that's ultimately a fairer starting point. And then once you do get to an interview stage, I'm a big believer in structured interviewing with scoring and things like that. And the reason that I'm a believer in that is because I think it's impossible to be 100% objective. But what I've found is that even when people say they're going on their instinct 9 times out of 10, once you get to that interview stage. So if you can say, these are the 10 questions we always ask for this role, and we're going to ask every single candidate the same questions. A lot of hiring managers push back on that and say, I get a sense and I go with my, feelings. but we know that's where the bias can really creep in.
Yeah.
So this was the first part of my conversation with Ella. And we touched upon mainly the part where you actually screen a resume. And there will be a second part of our discussion, which is all about blind recruitment beyond the CV. So what actually happens prior to even posting your job opening, sourcing candidates, etc., and what also happens after you've screened a candidate resume. So I hope you will be there on our next episode.